Everything that has made America, America is at stake. That's why today I'm announcing my candidacy for President of the United States. Folks, America's an idea. An idea that's stronger than any army, bigger than any ocean, more powerful than any dictator or tyrant. It gives hope to the most desperate people on earth. It guarantees that everyone is treated with dignity and gives hate no safe harbor.
Joe Biden announcing today he's running for president. He is the 20th, yes, 20th Democrat to enter the race. Party strategists hope he will appeal to the white working class men who historically have voted for Democrats but went for Donald Trump in 2016. However, black women and women of color in general are the most solid block of votes for the Democratic Party. They are demanding candidates pay more attention to them this cycle. At a forum in Texas last night, sponsored by a group called She the People, eight of Biden's opponents had to answer one big question: why should women of color vote for you? Well, to help us explore that question a little more is Juanita Tolliver. She's campaign director at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Also joining us is Zahra Bilou. She is spokeswoman for She the People. Welcome to you.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so you were there last night, Zahra. What was the reaction to the crowd last night? Which of those candidates did the audience like the most?
You know, there's been mixed feedback because everyone's bringing their biases into the room. But what I've seen and heard the most is that people were really most excited about Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris. They got the most applause, the most standing ovations, and their answers did well on that backdrop.
Right. And they are obviously two women, and this was yes, a woman-focused event. So was that points in their favor, their gender?
I think that it is really important that women like me, who were in that audience yesterday, see ourselves on those stages. I mean, full disclosure, I've been a fan of Bernie since 2016, but there's something really empowering about seeing someone who looks like me on that stage after a lifetime of thinking that that might not be possible in this country, and really resonating with what they are saying, which for me, again, unfortunately, was not the case in 2016.
Right. And so I understand that Bernie Sanders got a mixed reception last night.
He did. He absolutely did. You know, I'll tell you that I went to his rally afterwards. I'm excited about what he's pushing, and I've appreciated that so much of what he advocated for just a few years ago is now in the mainstream. He has set the trend in so many ways. But women of color want more, are pushing him on his language, are going to push him really hard. He is leading in the polls, and that tells me something about sort of where we are and what needs to be done to unify behind whoever gets the nomination.
And Juanita, let's turn to you now. What is your reaction to the news that Joe Biden, I mean, it's not news, he's been rumored to be doing this for a month, for a while.
And leading the polls the entire way, right?
Yeah, is now in the race for real.
I think it's something that a lot of people are excited about, right? Like, this is Barack Obama's VP. He's widely popular and known as that role. But I think a lot of folks are going to hang back a little bit and see how his campaign actually functions in this new kind of progressive environment and a more diverse electorate. Will he be inclusive in his policy ideas? What is his campaign style going to be? How is his messaging going to be able to appeal to both white male older voters, who he really has a draw with, as well as people in communities of color?
Yeah. Well, okay. So in that video that he made announcing his candidacy, he did reference Charlottesville.
He did reference Charlottesville, and honestly, to take care with that. Charlottesville is still a very emotional and enraging incident for a number of Americans and communities of color, and I really would not like to see Charlottesville considered a prop or any type of moment that can be leveraged in that way. But what he did a good job of was highlighting the fact that Donald Trump is unfit for office, and he made that message clear. Now, who that message was directed towards, I'm sure that's going to hold larger sway with, again, those older white male voters or even moderate Republicans who will be willing to change their votes from Trump support to supporting a Democrat.
Well, do you think, I mean, I'm sure he wants this, but do you think it's possible that he can be all things to all people?
No one can be all things to all people. But I think even remembering how he became Barack Obama's VP is going to be important here, right? Like, he was selected as Obama's running mate because he appealed to a very different audience than Obama. And again, that audience is comprised largely of white older men in key states. Now, his affiliation with Obama is definitely going to carry him far. It already has, not only for on name recognition, but his relationship with community of color. But in order to really make it through the next 18 months successfully, he's going to have to quickly identify his own lane within this race with 19 other competitors. Again, in an evolving progressive environment that he hasn't really been engaging in. I haven't seen him really roll out any bold progressive policies or even respond to some of the progressive topics that have been on the table yet.
Well, he has reached out to Anita Hill herself. He's phoned her, according to the New York Times today. He wants to meet with her. He has apologized to Anita Hill about running the hearings, you know, back in the day, back in the 90s, not calling additional witnesses to bolster her claims of sexual harassment by Clarence Thomas. And so he has apologized for that. Is that enough, do you think?
I mean, he apologized, but also not long ago, he said he wished he could do more. And as the sitting chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee at the time, overseeing the hearings, he was in the ultimate position of control to do the most for Anita Hill to ensure that she received justice. And so this is definitely something that is going to be relitigated again and again, and hopefully he'll get it right.
And Zahar, how do you feel about that? How do you feel about how he has handled the whole Anita Hill affair?
I mean, it's hard, right? Because I'd like to think that people can recover from terrible decisions and terrible actions, terrible policy work, you know, some time ago. But the reality is, can they, right? And it's not even to say, like, do we forgive you? Are you a bad person or a good person? It's, are you the best person to lead this country in this moment? And I'm not sure that I see that with him. I'm not sure that I see that in how he's handling the Anita Hill sort of fallout, if that's even the right word, so many years later. But, like, you know, it manifests in so many other ways. He could have timed his, he knew about the forum, he knew about his announcement. Part of me just wonders, yo, like, you should have showed up to this room of 1,700 women of color yesterday. Like, you should have timed your announcement so that you could be there and you could tell us in person. And so I'm not convinced, and his timing has really bothered me throughout all of this, because I think that there are ways to say that I'm going to do better, that I'm learning. And I'm not seeing him come all the way. And again, like, for me, it's there's only one job. This isn't 10 jobs or 20 jobs. This is one. And so though we may say he's moving forward, that doesn't make him the top contender for me.
He'll be in Pennsylvania tonight. So obviously he is trying to appeal to that state, the swing state, very important state in 2020. You know, and this is this code for you that he's focusing more on that constituency, sort of more of a white constituency than the constituency that was represented at your forum last night?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, something, I believe it was Elizabeth Warren who was asked about this, right? Which group of voters do we focus on? She said we need to focus on both. And so a candidate that is, whether intentionally or unintentionally, seeming like they are prioritizing one group, white middle-class voters versus women of color versus any other group, isn't going to be able to unite the party. And that's what we need now more than anything.
Right. So, but again, you said no, and you're both correct. You can't be all things to all people. So how do you do that?
The question of could he have been in Texas last night and Pennsylvania today is a little bit easier than could he be all things for all people, right? That's simply a geography question. I think he could have been in both places.
And Juanita, what about you? I mean, both places metaphorically. Do you think that he needs to do that?
I think he definitely needs to really divide his time accordingly. I think we see signs with his staffing selections that he has full intention of doing. I mean, the hiring of Simone Sanders, who I'm sure was largely sought after by a number of campaigns, will give him a broad access to young people and communities of color, as well as, let's be real, advice on engaging with her former boss, Senator Bernie Sanders. And I also think there is something here related to his record and legacy, especially as it relates to issues impacting communities of color, like his tough on crime policies that, to some degree, fueled mass incarceration and the war on drugs, both issues that disproportionately impacted communities of color. So it's really a question of what is he going to do to, one, recognize these errors and course correct so that people of color feel that he is someone who has their best interests at heart, understands their concerns, and is actively looking to improve their lives and rectify some of the issues.
Well, certainly Hillary Clinton had the support of Black women in particular. I think she had 89% of the whole African-American vote in 2016. And yet the turnout wasn't as high as it was with Barack Obama running for office in both elections. So I guess there could be the enthusiasm in general, but then when it comes time to vote, not enough to actually get out the vote. So how does that change this time around?
Yeah, I kind of reject the premise of that because I don't look at it as, oh, this is an election loss based on the fact that there was lower turnout by African Americans versus 53% of white women voting for Trump, mm-hmm. right? Like, I think that's a very, very different notion that I don't want to get misconstrued here. He won because he had the support of 53% of white women, not because Black people didn't turn out. Though I will say, in the 2008 election, African Americans and communities of color in general were unabashed about their support for Barack Obama because he was an African-American person who they identified with. And so that is something that energy is not going to be replicated for Joe Biden. He is not Barack Obama, and that's why it's even more important for him to not attempt to ride the wave of his affiliation with Obama as far as he can, but instead quickly identify his own lane, show up in Texas when there are opportunities to engage communities of color, and really make a lane for himself in this evolving progressive environment.
Okay, well, just one final question. Do you see that same kind of level of enthusiasm among the Black electorate? I know it's really early days so far, but so far, when it comes to Kamala Harris or Cory Booker?
I think there's definitely energy there. Kamala Harris had a massive rollout, 22,000 individuals showing up, raised $1 million within 24 hours. She has really stuck out as someone who has that support and has that energy and can move forward. Even looking at her polling numbers compared to a Sanders or Biden, she is in this fight and right up front. So absolutely there's energy for both of those candidates from the African-American community.
All right. I want to leave it there. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Juanita Tolliver, Campaign Director at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and Zahra Bilou, Executive Director at CARE San Francisco and spokeswoman for She the People. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the potential huge changes Los Angeles could undergo if a state housing bill passes, and how to work the loan process for a UC. Those stories next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. I do not need to tell you how expensive housing in Los Angeles is. There are various ideas out there to drive down costs, rent control, building more affordable housing. And one that's gaining a lot of political traction lately could, if approved, really change the nature of our city. It would allow developers to build bigger apartment buildings in neighborhoods not normally zoned for tall buildings. Senate Bill 50 made it through a crucial committee hearing in Sacramento yesterday. KCRW reporter Anna Scott is here now with the details. Hi there.
Hello.
Okay, so before we get into the nitty-gritties of SB 50, let's talk about the big idea here. What would it do?
Yeah, well, like you said, housing is really, really expensive here in LA and in a lot of other parts of California, like San Francisco. We also have a pollution problem because we drive everywhere. So one big reason for all of this is that for decades, cities and counties all over the state have failed to build enough housing for everyone who wants to live here. They have not kept up with the demand, so prices are high and people are forced to live further and further away from where they work. This bill, which was introduced by State Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco, basically says, okay, cities, okay, counties, you've had your chance. You've known about this problem for a really long time. Now the state is going to come in and force you to make some changes. It's going to force you to allow more housing near public transportation and near jobs.
So denser housing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he did this last year, right? He introduced a similar bill last year and it failed.
Right. And it's, you know, it's hard at this point to say exactly what this would look like in Los Angeles, because it's really important to know that this is a work in progress. But one of the big things that it would do in its current form is it would allow you, if you own a single family home anywhere in the state, to automatically be able to convert that into a fourplex.
So it would be the existing house. You could turn it into.
You could convert it. A lot of it, though, like I said, a lot of moving parts, a lot of it's probably likely to change. But I can tell you also what its goal is. It's really targeting wealthier neighborhoods, near job centers, near public transportation, that are low density, that are suburban, have a lot of single family homes. And it's trying to open up those neighborhoods and let more people live there. And
so like a Santa Monica, for example.
Right. Palms. Palms is one area that would be likely to change significantly if this were to pass, because it's near the Expo Line and it has that kind of mm-hmm. suburban feel. And it's not necessarily with, you know, doing this with skyscrapers and tall buildings, turning these neighborhoods into Dubai, as one LA City Councilman famously said last year when this came around. But it's about encouraging 4-5-story buildings, more duplexes, more fourplexes.
And how far do they have to be from the public transportation corridor to be able to qualify?
Roughly within half a mile of a major public transit line.
All right. So this has gotten a lot of attention in the last week. And one reason is because State Senator Scott Wiener got into a public spat with Michael Weinstein, who is the head of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation and is also very interested in housing policy.
Right. And he's one of the most outspoken opponents to SB 50 because of the affordability issue. It's not just Michael Weinstein that's concerned about this, that if you open up a lot more of the city to denser development, you're going to have developers coming in and potentially displacing renters, low-income renters who are already there and causing gentrification. Now, if you don't know anything about Michael Weinstein or the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, you at least have probably seen their billboards.
STD billboards.
Right, advertising their free STD testing mm-hmm. services. There's a famous one that says syphilis explosion, and there is an image of a volcano on that. That's important context here because AIDS Healthcare Foundation, Michael Weinstein, sent out this same kind of attention-getting ad in regards to SB 50. They sent out these mailers in San Francisco recently that had a photo of James Baldwin on them, the writer and civil rights activist, and a quote. Basically, the mailer was comparing SB 50 to racist development schemes of the 40s and the 50s that pushed a lot of Black people out of San Francisco. So Scott Wiener went on a Twitter tirade pretty much last week, attacking AHF, slamming Michael Weinstein for all sorts of things. And then this week, Michael Weinstein and Scott Wiener had dueling press conferences within an hour of each other. Wiener has one where he's joined by Black community leaders from San Francisco, slamming Weinstein, AIDS Healthcare Foundation, and their tactics.
This offensive, false, misleading mailer full of lies about Senate Bill 50, SB 50.
Meanwhile, Weinstein, the same day, has a phone press conference where he stands by the mailer.
Senator Wiener is trying to change the subject. We believe that gentrification has had a devastating impact on traditional communities, and that SB 50 will make it much, much worse.
So it's important to say that SB 50 does have a number of provisions in it that are designed to protect existing renters, especially low-income renters, from losing their homes if this were to pass. It also has affordable housing requirements, but Weinstein says it doesn't go far enough. He also announces this week that his organization has filed paperwork for a ballot measure next year that would expand rent control throughout the state of California.
How influential, though, is he, really? Well, I mean, in this SB 50 debate?
Well, it's hard to measure exactly how influential Michael Weinstein AHF is. I think what's more helpful is to step back and look at this Wiener versus Weinstein fight as a clash of ideologies that really does go beyond these two guys and comes up a lot as LA looks for solutions to this housing crisis. Weinstein is coming from this overarching belief in preservation, in keeping renters who have cheap apartments in place, protecting them, but also preserving single-family neighborhoods, these suburban neighborhoods that have defined Los Angeles for a long time. Scott Wiener is coming from the position that we really have to change the way we think about our cities. We have to make room for more people. We have to build more in our neighborhoods in order to have sustainable communities.
Of the 50 states, California ranks number 49 in homes per capita. Number 49 in homes per capita. And we are seeing the carnage that this is causing in our state every day.
In the form of our affordability crisis.
Mm-hmm. Mayor Garcetti, where is he on this?
Well, he has not come out and taken a position either way. He did put out a statement yesterday that said he's working with Senator Wiener, that he's happy with the latest changes to the bill. He's going to keep working with Senator Wiener on it, but stopped short of saying that he supports this.
But we are early in this process. It's passed one Senate committee. It's got to go through some others, and it's got to go through the Assembly, and then it's got to go to the governor. So what's the timeline here?
Yeah. So if it does go through that whole process and makes it to the governor's desk, we're looking at sometime in September. But the governor hasn't taken a position on it yet. It's definitely not a sure thing that it's going to sail through that whole process. So we'll just have to see what happens in the next few months.
All right. Anna Scott, reporting on housing for KCRW. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It is an important time now for high school seniors. The deadline to decide which college they want to attend in the fall is in 5 days. One big consideration, cost. Student loan debt is at an all-time high. The price of a college degree just keeps going up, even at public universities. At California's UCs, most students rely on at least some financial aid and hopefully some grants or scholarships. And yet, most will still graduate with some debt. Joining us to break down how financial aid works here in California is Cruz Grimaldo. She's the Director of Financial Aid and Scholarships at UC Berkeley. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, well, first of all, how much does it cost now to attend your university, UC Berkeley?
Right. So for next year, we look at the total cost of attendance, which includes the living expense and books, and it is about $35,000 to attend.
Is that for in-state?
Correct.
So like double that for out-of-state?
Correct. There's a supplemental tuition for out-of-state students that nearly does double the cost. That cost of attendance would be closer to $65,000.
Wow. All right. So safe to say a lot of people can't afford to pay that in cash or out of pocket. So how many of your undergraduates who are entering in the fall, how many of them rely on some form of aid?
Well, from our total undergraduate population, about 65% of our students receive some form of financial aid, and about 40% of our students come from families below $80,000, and so they essentially pay no tuition.
No tuition at all?
No tuition at all, and so really they have enough scholarship and grant aid to cover the cost of the tuition, and they really need to, you know, have resources for the other living expenses, living for their food and books and housing. But we also provide awards to cover those costs. We have a very strong work-study program, and we also offer both subsidized and unsubsidized loans.
Okay. So when you decide who's going to get a grant or who's going to get a scholarship or who's going to get some help, you look first at that. You look at whether or not their family is above or below a certain threshold.
Absolutely. We use the federal algorithm for determining a family's financial strength, and over 90% of the aid that we award on our campus is directed to needy students.
So that's the so-called FAFSA, right?
Correct. And for students who are ineligible for federal aid, California students can complete the California Dream application.
What about for parents? Do you think parents should take on the loans, or do you think students should?
Well, you know, students do have a maximum that they are allowed to borrow through the federal program, but the aid methodology does consider this a partnership between parents and students and the institution. And we know that all students may not have a family situation, and we can take that into account if there's been some family estrangement or if they're over a certain age.
So it's financially better for the student to take the loan out, right?
Absolutely, because those loans, if they're need-based, tend to be subsidized, and meaning that any interest that accrued is being subsidized by the federal government.
But they're looking at the parent's financial situation when deciding that.
They absolutely are.
Yeah, that's the conundrum then, right?
You know, I do think that there's, I think for a state like California, there is a challenge in that the federal formula does not have any regional sensitivity. And so a family's financial strength in California is measured the same way as a family's financial strength in a different state where perhaps the costs are much lower. Then that can create an inequity for our students in that income is not going as far in our state. And so there is a state program, the middle class scholarship program, that tries to alleviate some of that for those middle-income families.
Is that only for in-state colleges and universities, or can California residents use that to go to out-of-state schools?
It's for California students and for schools in California.
What do you think the price keeps going up, right? I mean, you're not going to discount that. Once their tuition increases, it's very rare that you actually get a tuition rollback of any significance. So what do you think that this is going to do to, you know, the so-called California dream, if you will, that was set up to make college affordable for anyone who was who could show promise and wanted to go to college?
I think that really there are a lot of scholarship opportunities out there. So I always encourage students to apply for as many scholarships as possible so that with all the pieces together, the loan that students may need to take out could be very reasonable.
So, but if they do get an outside scholarship, that affects their financial aid package, right?
It reduces their loan and work expectation first before it would displace any of their gifts or scholarships. So that would be a great way to keep their loan and their work obligations as low as possible.
But you can't get a work study maybe if you have an outside scholarship?
Well, it would first replace loans, and then before it would replace work study. And the loan and work expectation for students for this coming year is about $9,500. So you'd have to really earn more than that $9,500 in external scholarships before it would displace any of the need-based gifts or scholarships.
So students right now, they've got 5 days to say whether or not they're going to accept an offer, and they're probably weighing competing offers.
Oh, absolutely.
So a lot of them are saying, look, I would love to go to this dream school, but I just can't afford it. And is it really worth it? Is it worth it to be saddled with debt for perhaps decades?
I think it's a highly personal decision, but I would encourage students and their families to review what that return on investment really is and what are the salaries, you know, once post-graduation. And there are calculators out there where you can start to estimate now what your loan repayments can be. And we know that in the upcoming election that potential loan forgiveness and perhaps some other other programs could be a factor.
Cruz Grimaldo, Director of Financial Aid and Scholarships at UC Berkeley. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, thousands of Hollywood writers fired their agents over packaging fees. So now what?
Writers are hustlers. Like, just to get into this career, you have to hustle. And I don't think anyone lost that muscle. And if anything, we're kind of, you know, improving on that and hustling more and helping each other out.
Writers acting as their own agents. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Hollywood is looking more and more like the Wild West these days for writers. The Writers Guild says more than 7,000 of its members have fired their agents. But the talent agencies are not backing down. And while the heavy hitters, you know, people like Shonda Rhimes or Stephen King, won't have any issues finding work without their agents, it is a different game for everyone else. So how are they finding work now without their agents? Here to tell us more is Mark Rizzo. He's a film and TV writer, and he's in the studio now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
And joining us on the line is Jeannie Wong, entry-level staff writer and script coordinator on the CW TV show Arrow. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi.
All right. Well, let's begin with you, Mark. Just explain what this whole standoff is over. It's something called packaging fees.
Packaging fees, yes. And what they constitute are a conflict of interest. And so basically, when a writer sells a show to a network or a studio, and the agency packages multiple pieces of talent with that show, the writer, the director, and actor, what they do is they say, hey, writer, great news. We will waive your 10% commission, the traditional way that we pay our agents, and we're going to do this thing called a packaging fee. And that packaging fee is negotiated with the studio, who is our employer. So basically, it takes the incentive away from the agents to negotiate the best salary possible for us. And so we're just asking the agencies to go back to the traditional 10% where our interests are aligned and they have an incentive to work as hard as they can on our behalf to get the best salary.
And just a note, we did reach out to agents and agencies to comment and they refused or they declined or they weren't available, what have you. So we are just talking to one side on this topic. They would say, well, look, this packaging deal makes it better for everybody and you're going to make more money this way because you don't have to pay us the 10%.
That remains to be seen. And this issue is larger and systemic. The numbers that I've seen from the Guild are that writers' salaries have been flat and declining over the past several years, and we're attributing that to packaging fees.
Okay, so the union says we are going to fire the agents if they don't agree to this change or to go back to the
Correct.
Way it was, right?
Well, a year ago, the Guild approached the agencies about this issue and sent them, you know, notice that we had a year to kind of work on this. And a year passed and there was really no response from the agencies. And so when we got into the nitty-gritty of negotiating, we put forth a code of conduct that would realign their interests with ours and take away the conflict of interest. And we didn't get anywhere in those negotiations. And so we had a vote as a guild on the code of conduct, and we got a 95% vote, like a really overwhelming amount of solidarity on this issue to vote yes on the code of conduct. And once the deadline passed, we left our agents and we're waiting for them to sign the code of conduct so we can come back and work together without a conflict of interest.
Okay. So you fired your agents. It's been, what, a week and a half?
About that, yeah.
Okay. And Jeannie, what does that mean for you now that you don't have an agent anymore? For now, at least.
As someone who, you know, loves my agent, it hasn't made that much of a difference because at the lower level, especially for a woman of color, you're doing a lot of your own networking and hustling. And usually getting your job, me getting my freelances, development that I've gotten, have all mostly been on my own, as much as, you know, my manager and agent have helped me with meetings in the past.
So are you kind of wondering, why do I have an agent at all anyway?
I do see a purpose for the agents and, you know, my manager. They are huge advocates for my career. And as a lower level writer, you need as many people advocating for you. But in my personal opinion, it's just hard anyway. You know, as someone who's done this, two of the studio diversity programs, and it doesn't make a difference in terms of the amount of work I have to do and how difficult it is for me to break in. But I do feel optimistic because there's a lot of solidarity with all the Twitter hashtags, the staffing boost and the solidarity challenge that's going on. I did hear of someone getting a staffing meeting at the lower level, I believe, through the WJA submission website. So one way of looking at it is maybe some people could say agents are not helpful, but I mean, at the end of the day, I still think agents are useful in a way, but now it's just realigning their goals with writers.
Mark, what about you? You've been in the business longer. You've had the same agent for some, what, 15 years,
yes.
I understand. What is that weird now? I mean, you must be friends on one level.
Oh, we are friends and not fake Hollywood friends. Like, we're real friends. And we had a conversation about it. And she was wonderful and really understanding. And I think we both understand that this isn't personal. This is systemic. And when I signed the letter leaving my agent, it was addressed to Creative Artist Agency. It wasn't with her name on it. And that felt, I think it would have been harder to put her name on it because we are very close and she's, you know, we've been working together for such a long time. But of course it's weird, you know, and like we're all very collegial. We're just in kind of an awkward, it's a little awkward right now. But I just want to second what Jeannie was saying about the incredible amount of solidarity and the way that the guild and the community of writers have stepped in to help each other out in this time.
So are people giving each other tips or, you know, leads on projects, things like that?
Oh, scads. The guild has set up a database for people to submit themselves to other writers and showrunners, because in the end, writers hire writers. So,
right. So it works like there's a head writer in a writer's room and they hire the other writers?
Correct. Okay. And we're in the midst of staffing season. And so the guild really has all hands on deck trying to help people get through this and find jobs. There's also, like Jeannie said, the Twitter hashtags. There are all these meetups and networking events. Mm-hmm. And as Jeannie said, writers are hustlers. Like, just to get into this career, you have to hustle. And I don't think anyone lost that muscle. And if anything, we're kind of, you know, improving on that and hustling more and helping each other out.
And Jeannie, how has that worked for you? I understand that you're developing a pilot right now.
Yeah. So I'm literally in the middle of like pitch, and I'm actually out with my producer today with some meeting stuff. And if anything, because of everything that has been going on and knowing that I'm a baby writer, she sort of has taken it upon herself as a woman who's been in the business for many years to go out of her way to introduce me to people and, you know, just help me meet people through that way. So I think, if anything, it's really made people really sort of open up. I mean, I wouldn't say we're going through like a natural disaster or anything like that, but you know how like in a moment of crisis, always look for the helpers. And I think that's sort of what I'm seeing right now. And it makes me really optimistic about all that's going on. But I have no qualms about how hard the journey is.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, these are early days. It's only 10 days into it or so. But what happens if this drags on for months and months? And can you envision a scenario where showrunners or other writers just go with who they know because it's just easier and they don't want to go through the whole process of trying to find someone that they don't know? And then the same writers get hired for the same projects over and over again.
I would say I disagree with that, because I think, if anything, a lot of the methods happening right now to hire writers feels a little bit outside of the system that we're used to. Mm-hmm. I think it will be a mix of both. I mean, obviously people will hire who they want to hire, but I think the way that things are opening up right now, I feel like there's a big possibility for, you know, shake up and for, you know, maybe writers who haven't worked in a while to get back in, you know, mid-career level writers or baby writers. I think there's a lot of possibilities.
Is that actually a term, baby writer?
It is. And I remember I heard a podcast with Craig Mazin and John August, the Script Notes podcast, and they had someone on and they said that we want to try to discontinue the use of that because it feels like a diminishing term for writers. And I would just encourage all writers who are new to the career to just say, I'm new to the career, young to the career. But yeah, it is kind of a term of art, the baby writer, the young writer. And, you know, and I think what that phrasing indicates is that there is a feeling of family, you know, among writers, and, you know, mentors reaching out to help people who are new to the career. And I, you know, I'm in touch with a lot of my friends right now, and thankfully, you know, most of us are working, but I have one friend who I've worked with and she's in the midst of staffing, and I know that she submitted through the guild system and she submitted through mentors and personal connections, and she sent me her list and I'm going through it and trying to help her find other connections. So everyone's out there hustling and taking care of themselves and advocating for themselves. And I think it's ultimately, I think it's really empowering for this community. I think the writer community has always been strong, but there's something about this moment where everyone is really pulling together and working together in a way that may have lasting effects beyond this. We all want to get to the other side of this.
Yeah.
We all want the agencies to sign the code of conduct and realign
their
interests
with
ours.
You want your agents back again. You're not envisioning a future where this could be the normal, the new normal, where you just don't have agents to represent you anymore, that they do other things.
And no, we like agents. We just want agents to have their interests aligned with ours and not have a conflict of interest.
You were in the writer's strike, right?
I was,
so
yeah.
So that was, what, 11 years ago. Yeah. And that was devastating for a lot of writers because it went dragged on and on and on, and people were out of work for a while.
Yeah, but the alternative would have been wildly devastating. I mean, what we were striking over, and I just want to make clear, what's happening now is not a strike. We're all working. I'm working on two feature film projects. I just got sent another one through the studio that I'm working with. we're working. In a strike, a work stoppage is much different.
Yeah.
And back then, we were striking over streaming. And we were told that, gosh, I don't know if there's any money in this internet thing. And lo and behold, we're all working for Netflix, Hulu, Apple, Amazon, and I don't know. Or over the over-the-top streaming services for Disney and mm-hmm. Warner. So, you know, there are fights worth fighting. And, you know, it was not a very convenient time for me. I was a writer new to the career in 2008 and 2009. And my career was just starting and it was
put
on hold. You
were a baby writer.
I was. And, you know, in that time, I was happy to feel the pain and, you know, march and picket because it was the right fight. And those picket lines were amazing. Like the sense of solidarity that you got there were wonderful. And I even caught a glimpse of Larry David walking to the picket line.
Even Larry David.
Yeah. And he's really tall, guys. I just didn't picture him that tall.
Yeah, he is. Well, that did have a ripple effect to the entire economy. Of Los Angeles, if you remember, because it affected set decorators, caterers, hairdressers, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. This obviously is, at this point, just confined to writers and agents.
Yes.
Do you know of anyone who's actually been negatively affected? I know it's early days, but...
No. You know, like I said, I'm a mid-career writer, mid-career, middle class, and I've, you know, been talking to a lot of my friends and everyone's working. And like I said, my one friend who is newer to the career, who isn't working, is out there hustling. And she has a lot of people hustling on her behalf. And I'm really confident that she's going to be okay.
Jeannie, what do you think? Do you know if anyone who's actually having a tough time?
I wouldn't say it's necessarily a tough time, but I have noticed like slight pettiness on like agency parts. An agency that did not rep me, but was repping someone else on a project that I'm on, attached to, and did not want to help set up a meeting or anything, or was just like, we would rather work with a non-WGA writer right now. Mm. But I understand that there are like sacrifices and I can't sort of control that. But again, like in these instances, I'm also lucky in terms of like, I could just talk directly to the creators and be like, we're still working together, right? And they're like, yeah. So
I just wanted to say that I think everyone's feeling more empowered to reach out and communicate with producers, studio executives, people with whom they have pre-existing relationships, and other writers. And I think it's a really great thing.
I mean, if you have those existing relationships.
Yeah, but I think that once you get into this career, you know, one of the great things about writing in film and television is that it's wildly collaborative. Writing itself is a very lonely thing, but writers' rooms and the community of writers out here, there's nothing else quite like it. And so, you know, we're all kind of in this together and helping each other.
All right. Well, thank you both very much for coming in and
You're
being
welcome.
Here together. Mark Rizzo, Jeannie Wong, both writers, TV writers, and movie writers. Coming up, the best taco in LA is down to the final four. Taco Madness, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. One thing is not up for debate. Angelinos do love their tacos. But where to find the best tacos in LA? That is, well, definitely up for debate. Now, LA Taco's annual competition, Taco Madness 2019, is in full force. It's down to the final four. Here to tell us about them is Daniel Hernandez, editor and host of the podcast LA Taco. Hi.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Good thing you're named LA Taco because you definitely should be hosting this Taco Madness thing. Okay. So help us out. We've got four finalists. Who are they?
Yes. So we have four finalists and there were really some big upsets in the early rounds of voting. Thousands of LA Taco readers and fans, and actually fans of a lot of these taquerias, have voted. But our final four now are Machin, Sonora Town, a birrieria, a restaurant that sells birria called Birrieria Gonzalez, and Birrieria La Unica. And they're kind of a social media star right now in particular because they have very famous big fans who are Chrissy Teigen and John Legend. But actually, all four of these places are incredible vaqueros, and we're really looking forward to the final round and who's going to come out on top of this wonderful taco bracket.
Yeah, well, upsets for sure, because where's Ricky's Fish Tacos? Where's Guisados?
Yes. Guisados, Teddy's Red Tacos, which got really famous also this year. Last year, they were featured on the Super Bowl. Gorilla Tacos, which is kind of a mainstay now, was also knocked out in a couple of the previous rounds. But I think these four kind of represent in their own way some of the pillars of, I would say, the taco universe in Los Angeles. Birria, this kind of beef or often goat stew, is really big in L.A. this year. A lot of birria taco trucks are really coming up. And of course, there's this with Machin, more of an Alta California flavor. These are slightly fancier, for lack of a better word, tacos, but they really focus on the tortilla, and they really focus on making these high-quality tortillas for very discerning tastes. So it's neck and neck. Check out LATaco.com to see where the bracket is.
Well, speaking of the tortilla, Sonora Town, controversial in some circles, yeah, because these flour tortillas.
They do, and flour. You know, I'm a descendant of kind of people from the north of Mexico, and flour is in the north kind of a default. L.A. is still kind of on the fence about embracing the flour tortilla, and yes, as you mentioned, Sonora Town is very famous. Actually, a lot of the draw for people who love flour tortillas is their specific flour tortillas, which of course reminds you of the state of Sonora in the north of Mexico. Mm-hmm. So that's a real question mark if people are really going to want to give that final vote to Sonora Town because they specifically use flour tortillas.
All right, you said that we're in a bit of a moment for birria. Why?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that's a good. That's actually a very good question. Birria is from the traditional states that have sort of now are kind of legacy kind of migration states. I'm talking about Jalisco, Michoacán, Zacatecas. We were really expecting some of the seafood spots or the Tijuana-style spots, which is also really big in L.A. in the past few years. These are questions that I think every taquero and every taco-loving person, which by default I think is everyone in L.A., should ask. I mean, we have tastes that sort of wander around, and it's really interesting as a journalist to watch the sort of ebb and flow of what are the kind of specific tacos that become popular and emerge and sort of become, I guess you could say, trends. So birria is an interesting case. It's obviously delicious. It's extremely flavorful, very rich. Often birria places will accompany a small cup of broth or consomé, as it's referred to in Spanish. So that might be one of the reasons. It's great hangover food as well. That might be another reason.
But it's about a little messy in a taco. I don't know.
It does, because birria is actually a little moister, more wet, So, yeah, you might need a second or third tortilla for one of those.
Just mop it up. Okay, are you going to put your finger on the scale at all and tell us which one you like the best?
Madeline, I am not. I'm so glad you asked. I'm actually not even voting in the bracket, although I did encourage all the LA Taco staff and community to pick their favorite. Actually, this week on the podcast, some of our top taco writers discussed the final four, so check that out. But I'm going to stay completely neutral up until the final moment and maybe revealing my favorite at our event, which is May 4th. I hope you can be there.
Okay, and that's next Saturday, and it's going to be where?
Yeah.
It's like
at
a live
La
event.
De Artes y Culturas.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's actually the 10th annual Taco Madness. And it's really cool because, we have the LA Times and the Food Bowl and a lot of these great big food institutions in our city. But Taco Madness has always been a very community oriented, independent event. So it's at La Plaza, right there by Olvera Street. It's totally free, so you don't pay a ticket up front to walk in. And there's going to be micheladas and food. Obviously, all of kind of the top tier of our bracket, or we've all invited them, so you can sample all these tacos there and hopefully come up and meet us and hang out, because, we definitely need a world so crazy right now, we could all use a little more tacos, right?
Definitely, and even when it's not so crazy. So go and vote, first of all, at LA Taco, right? And then go eat.
There you go.
Next weekend. All right, Dan Hernandez, editor and host of the podcast LA Taco. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Michelle Aloy, put your thumb on the scale. What's your favorite taco place?
So I feel like I kind of live in a taco desert.
Because you're on where?
I mean, like Palms on the west side. There's this new place that opened up called La Esquina that's really good. But I got to check out Sonora Town. Like, they've got a write-up in the LA Times. They won the tortilla contest.
They won our best tortilla.
I mean, but like, I got to say, the flour tortilla is a little off-putting. My, you know, my dad grew up in Guadalajara and he's full corn. He's all corn. All hashtag team corn. Victor Loy.
Oh, I like a good flour tortilla. I mean, not at one of those massive ones.
I'm going to have to undo the indoctrination, I think, that I have.
Exactly. You're in LA now.
I know.
Okay. Thank you, Michelle Aloy. And thank you, taco fans. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.